Welcome back to another episode of the Guards Podcast. Today we're joined by Command Sergeant Major Kenneth Kachina, who is now the State Command Sergeant Major of North Dakota. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Command Sergeant Major.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this. Hopefully, I don't mess it up too bad.
So. No, I think it'll be pretty good. It'll be pretty
all right.
Good. So just to give a quick recap for people that might not know much about your career, and then I'll just have you fill in the blanks after. So you enlisted in 2000. You completed basic training at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. You did advanced individual training as a Stinger crew member at Fort Bliss in Texas. You've been an Avenger squad leader, Avenger platoon sergeant, battalion Avenger master gunner, a first sergeant. You were command sergeant major of the 142 Engineer Battalion out of Valley City. And your most recent position was the commandant of the 164th Regional Training Institute at Camp Grafton Training Center, Devil's Lake. To add to all that, you were also a admin non-commissioned officer, a supply NCO, readiness NCO, battalion operations NCO with the ADA, and the brigade operations NCO with the 141 Maneuver Enhancement Brigade. And you also have a deployment to Iraq, a deployment to Afghanistan, and you also served in the National Capital Region. So I think that kind of puts, you know, your mantle of everything you've done. And a nice little short overview, but what sparked your initial decision to actually join the North Dakota Army National Guard?
Well, looking back, you know, it's been in kind of a family thing. I mean, my family's dedicated to service. My grandfather was in World War II, and then my dad served in the Guard during the Vietnam era. Multiple uncles as well. Looking way back when I was young, I started playing the trumpet way back when I was in the band, right? And I was probably, I don't know, fifth grade, fourth grade, something like that. And I had a great uncle, Charlie, that played taps always for the Pisac American Legion. That's the little town where I grew up is Pisac, North Dakota. But the Legion had a big, strong presence in the community. And we'd always do services at the Pisac community, the Pisac Church, and then Vesaville Church, Conway. And it really was one of those things where they asked me eventually to play the echo when we played taps. So I started there, and I thought, you know, that was one of the most important things that I did as a youngster and growing up, and I just felt that connection to the military that way. As I gone through school, and my story is a little bit, you know, you said I did join in 2000. I was a split up. I was teaching at the time, and I decided, you know what, it's time for me to look at this career in the military or see what I can do. I was looking to get a little additional money for college. I had some loans and things like that, but I also had that desire to go back to that connection to the military. It was funny because we were talking about this with my mom recently, and she said, I called her after I had decided to join, and she said, I had spoken, hey, there's nothing really going on in the world. It's a calm time right now, and everything's is smooth sailing, so I'm going to join the Guard, do this, work to get my master's degree eventually, and stay as a teacher and maybe in administration. But of course, then, you know, 9/11 happened. And that, of course, I had finished basic training at Fort Sill, and then went on to go back to teaching. And while we were conducting the training, I guess, during IDTs, back then there was an RSP. So I was with my unit. I got to know my unit immediately. So I had that whole year with them. And I trained as a Stinger crew member. We had table training that we conducted, and I was table 6 qualified already, hadn't been to AIT or anything like that. And I don't think that a lot of the let's say the battalion commander command at the time really knew that I wasn't even completely done with AIT yet, because we got called in right after 9/11 to come in and start train up, and we didn't know what it was going to look like, but we knew we were probably going to be involved in something. So immediately my squad leader was like, hey, this guy's he's trained up, he's ready to go. And they did some digging, did some looking into our medical and everything else, administrative, getting ready. And RS1 said, wait a second, this guy's not even done with AIT. He can't deploy, he can't go anywhere. So that kind of curbed it a little bit. So I was sent back home and said, well, you got to wait till you go to AIT and finish that, which I did then that following summer. Was completely trained in that regard. But I guess to answer that question, we went a long ways, but I guess back, you know, being a youngster, having that connection, and then really for school, I guess, but then it sparked something more in me as of course, the geopolitical climate changed and things started to get into motion after 9/11. So
what was your drive then to, like, obviously they didn't realize you haven't been to AIT yet. They must have thought, like, all right, this guy's just really sharp. But what was your drive that you just wanted to be that?
So I was an older soldier. Obviously, I went to basic when I was 29. So I had kind of already a pretty good direction of where I wanted to go, what I wanted to do. I felt that I was pretty good at being able to learn on the fly, learn things quickly, and implement them. I wanted to be the best at whatever I'm doing. It didn't matter whether it was sports or whether it was school or whether it was whatever profession, whatever thing I chose. I wanted to be the best at it. There were some, I guess, competitions when we were training. I mean, we had visual aircraft recognition, VACR, stuff like that. We challenge each other at drill to know every single plane that we could, from enemy to friendly, and it was just became a competition among our squad, our team that we had, and things like that, general knowledge on anything, and the realization, hey, I hadn't even been to AIT yet, but I was able to do that. So I guess the good relationships that I made early on really sparked me to drive to try to be the best among the best is what I was trying to do. Yeah.
And you talked about just barely the relationships early on, in that early career. Can you pick like a specific moment or experience that really solidified your commitment to the military?
So, I enjoyed the discipline, the structure, those things that drew me, and it's something that, I think fills in with teaching, with coaching, with kind of mentoring, all of those things. But there was one event that I remember very vividly, and it was after 9/11 had happened, and prior to our deployment to Iraq in 2004. But it was the birth of my daughter, Peyton. She was about 7 weeks early, and she was born in April of 2003. And of course, that week, my wife got rushed to the hospital. She was backwards, and we had to emergency C-section. She was in an isolate for about almost 10 days. And of course, over that time, I had a PT test. I had drill, and I had a PT test. And we were in Grand Forks at the time, so I left. I was there the whole time, sitting by my wife is in care there, and then my daughter was in the isolate, so I spent time just kind of sleeping in the hospital. And I went to drill, and I walked in, and at the time it was our battalion XO at the time, it was Colonel Fuger. And he met me at the door, and he said, what the heck are you doing here? And she just have a baby? And I said, well, yes, sir, but we had drill, and I've got a PT test. And he goes, he looked at me and said, all right, take the dang PT test and get the heck out of here. Go spend time with your family. You need to be there. And that to me was a strong building moment that the Guard really is not just, a job, a profession. It's a family, and you need to make sure that you're taking care of your people. And he did that, and my squad did that, my platoon did that. There was no question that my commitment was there. And they were like, you gotta spend time with her. So all good things. Peyton is fine, by the way. She's doing very well. She's 22 years old now. So. But that was a big moment, I think, that really defined, that time for me in the Guard. So, yeah.
Definitely that Guard family taking care of you and then paying back in dividends because you're still here. Yeah. You're still doing it.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So when we started looking at all your different career roles, positions, everything we talked about that, you said you started as a Stinger crew member, and then you work all the way up to Commandant of the RTI in Devil's Lake, and now you're the State Command Sergeant Major. Yeah. And really, you're not.
That's crazy.
Not getting much higher than that.
Yeah.
On the NCO side. So how has experiencing so many different Army positions and perspectives shaped your understanding of the organization?
Yeah, in the ADA, it's funny, I felt like we were, probably at that level, at the unit level, you're kind of, this is my own little piece of the pie. I didn't see the bigger picture, right? As a, like you said, as a crew member on the MDA side and my job there, but also on the full-time side. So I was a traditional soldier until we deployed to Iraq in 04. And so on the coming back, I was hired into AGR My teaching job had that's a long another long story I don't want to get into, but I was teaching in Warwick, Minnesota at the time, and they had a reduction in force. So my position was completely cut. Nothing ESGR could do or anything like that. It was just a school budgeting issue. And so I decided at that point, well, maybe this full-time gig's going to be something I could do, I could be good at. I got some good advice from some senior mentors, and they said, yep, throw your hat in the ring for, and I got hired into the S4. And so with that, working there and seeing that piece of it, that broadened my mind even more, because as an MDA guy, I was applying for the assistant S4 to the battalion, and I didn't even know what the heck S4 was. I mean, I was a new E5. I deployed to Iraq. I was deployed when I interviewed, and I wasn't concerned about supply, or I was, you know, making sure my team and my squad was ready to roll out the door and do the mission. And so I remember doing the interview going, yeah, I think it's supply, but I'm not sure. I have no idea what the S shop stand for. So that shows a very limited probably view of the Army, but also focused more to that level. As I started working through the next level, getting back to battalion, and seeing how the battalion ran and understand, oh crap, we got units, you know, in Bismarck, we've got units in Fargo now, and we've got a detachment in Grand Forks. So the battalion itself is spread out, and seeing that, how it fit together. As I progressed then to, you know, supply and then to training and then readiness eventually, it really got me focused on how the overall battalion fits with the other battalions within the state. And once I got to the brigade at Brigade Operations, that blew my mind even more. I know I talked to retired now State Command Sergeant Major Heck, who was the Brigade Operations NCO when I took over. And he kept telling me, you've got to take the blinders off, you got to see the big picture. And I never understood what he was talking about until I got to the brigade, and I went, oh wow, this is something. So I remember my working unit status reports, USRs, in the SIPR room at the ADA level. I was one battalion doing that. All of a sudden, I'm in charge of 17 different USRs across the brigade. So that really kind of showed me, wow, there's a lot going on. When I got over to the RTI, that's a whole nother example of me having blinders on. I'd never even been really, besides the auditorium, toured the RTI or anything like that. I had no idea what the heck I was getting into there. I knew I knew the good people that worked there, a few of them, but I didn't understand the mission and the impact that they have and what they do and the excellence that they bring. So that really broadened me on how that fits into now. Really dealing with this position now, it's great to see all aspects of the MTO units, the TDA units, and how everything fits together, along with that strategic view from TAG and from the Army Commander, and how that ties together, and what my role is going to be in that, and how I can kind of hopefully get that agenda across and get the things we need to get done, look into the future. But
yeah, and you sort of hit on this a little bit already. You know, you talked about a lot of those operational roles.
Yeah.
But as you move, not just from operational roles, but to leadership positions, you know, you said squad leader, you were also platoon sergeant, first mm-hmm. sergeant, a battalion CSM, and then the RTI commandant. You said the blinders opened up even more when you started dealing with a lot of active duty students coming in, reserve students coming in. So what was your biggest challenge in transitioning from level to level, and then, you know, from a technical expert on a small team to a leader that's responsible at those multiple echelons of people?
Right on. Yeah, it's definitely that, you know, that when you're thinking about at that squad leader, at that team leader level. So there's a good story, or not maybe a story, but something I used when I was at the RTI, talking with especially our 40 level students that come in, the SLC students, and I would ask them, you know, from their perspective, who's the leader at the platoon? Who's the lowest level leader at the platoon? And they'd go, well, they'd think about it, and they go, well, the team leader. Yeah, okay, E5s, yep, team leader. They got responsibility. They're the leaders at that level, right? So I said, okay, then who is the next level leader? So I go, squad leader, right? Yep, because we're an NCO academy, right? So we're looking at that, talking about leaders at the NCO level too. And they go, yep, okay, so you got the team leader, then you got the squad leader, okay. Who is the next level leader? You know what they'd say right away? Well, platoon sergeant. And I said, wait a second. Where is leader and platoon sergeant? And they looked at me like, what? And then it clicked for some of them. They go, oh, it's a platoon leader. And I, ah, yeah. Now you're onto something, because that is your next level leader, right? Your squad leader, your team leader, squad leader, platoon leader. So I said, what's the role then of the platoon sergeant? Well, to advise, to give advice, to get the pulse of the platoon, to help that platoon leader along, right? I said, that's exactly, you know, what you're talking about in terms of echelon leadership, leader at echelon. And I said, yep, so now let's look at this, I said. So when you're a platoon leader, and then you're a platoon sergeant, that's a command relationship that is a unique, it's a first-time command relationship. But where are we at in terms of career? And they think about that for a while. So a platoon sergeant's kind of a crusty old E7, you know, it's been probably in for 16, 17 years, has probably a couple of deployments maybe, a couple of NTC rotations, whatever it may be. Lots of experience, annual trainings, you know. A PL is probably, unless they're, you know, we're a non-commissioned officer and maybe took, you know, a commission, they've probably got a couple of years in, right? They're very inexperienced. So what's that role look like? What are we supposed to do as NCOs in that role? Yeah, we got to mentor that PL. We got to try and get him or her to understand what the platoon is, what the mission is. You know, those that level and you know, kind of work through that and make sure that they're meeting the mark that we need them to meet. So they like, you know, we talked about that, you know, quite a bit. And then we said, okay, let's look at the next level then. All right, because we talked about the platoon sergeant. So what's next? Well, it's going to be the first sergeant, right? And then, well, now we got a company commander, right? We got a company commander and we got a first sergeant together. What's that look like? Well, that company commander maybe had XO time, maybe probably just went from PL right to company command, maybe has 5 years, maybe 6 years. How about that first sergeant? Well, now we're looking at someone with 18, 20, 22 years experience, lots of time. So that's another role that we're mentoring. We're working with that commander. But we're seeing a bigger picture now. We're seeing a bigger picture across, you know, the entire company, not and battery, not just at the platoon level. And then we finally get to where I'd like to get to, which I think is where the most impact that you can have is at the battalion level. That's really where I think you really hit your stride, because I asked them, well, now let's look at that. Let's look at the battalion CSM. They've got that, you know, they're over 20 years probably, you know, give or take, maybe a few short, but somewhere in there. That battalion commander now, what have they done? They've been at the platoon level, you know, the PL, probably XO company commander, and boom, they go out to staff. And they're maybe a 3, maybe a 4, maybe a 6, whatever it is they're doing, working their career, working that understanding, and they finally get to that level. Now, here we are. Now we're even. We're on an even playing field. And man, when you hit that stride, you see a big, big picture, not just of the battalion, but how the battalions work in the state and then beyond. I will say the time I had at the 142 with Colonel Bull, Colonel Bob Bull was my battalion CSM. That was phenomenal. I had no idea like what makeup even the 142 really, I mean, I did it enough as being brigade operations, so I had some, but I was like, wow, when I got there and I saw our first annual training was the brigade all annual training that we did at Camp Ripley. And those bubbas in the field were, oh man, they were good workers and understanding their mission and what to do. And Colonel Bull and I talked so much road time, so much windshield time about how an engineer battalion works. And I think I brought a lot of questions to him that he probably hadn't thought about because of his experiences. So we had really good conversation, really good talk about how we can get involved more, probably just not within the battalion, but how the battalion ties in with the state, with the other battalions. So that's kind of, that's a long answer, I guess, to your question, but it kind of is important at each echelon, how that kind of, that role kind of gets you prepared for that next step. No.
So that kind of ties into what I was going to ask next too, is, you know, you talk about spending that significant time at the battalion and the brigade level, you know, as an operations NCO and as a command sergeant major, and you kind of made the argument that that's the nice sweet spot between operations and your strategic planning, because you get to do all of it, and especially if you have a battalion, like that's where the readiness and like lethality is at that level, and you can really command and control there. So how did those experiences shape your understanding of the operational side and how you can apply that with strategic and your leadership role within those?
You know, when you're talking about at that operational level, it's the now. It's almost immediate. There's so many times, like through the deployments, preparing for deployments, there's drills and things like that are always in the immediate. What do I need to do almost today. What are my 50 meter targets? What are my really my year objectives? That's kind of what I'm looking at. When you're thinking about strategic, that view, that changes when you're looking to that far out in the future. Like, what do we need to do? What initiatives do we need to put into place now to see effect down the road? And that's a hard jump in terms of, I guess, where you're at in your career. Maturity helps with that. Education helps with that. Understanding the mission, the vision of the entire enterprise, that helps. So getting the time at each echelon and then having good mentors, having good people to talk with and kind of, I guess, shape that future and having that good understanding vision of where we are, what we need to do. So I guess that that's a tough one to nail down. It's a good question. It's a tough one to nail down because you operate in both, I think, especially at this level. It's still, it's more strategic, obviously, even at the RTI, at the Commandant level. But I still enjoy being at the operational level more. Direct approach, working directly with our instructors, for example, trying to make sure we have a good path for career management, making sure we're putting the right people in the right places. And that is operational, and yet it is strategic because I'm trying to look down the future out past, 1, 2, 3 years. How do we look as in the guard? How do we look with equipment? How do we look with training? How do we look with those things we're trying to build to the future? So,
and then you've already mentioned a couple people, but who are some of the key mentors helped influence you throughout your career? And like, what are some big lessons you took from those mentors?
I think my dad, I'll go back to him. I mean, he's a veteran, he was in the military, but he taught me, I think one of the best things that I carried was my work ethic. The things that he told me, you've got to put your best forward. You got to work hard. The good things will come. So that's something that he told me. Another good point he gave me is don't self-select. And I think that's a good point for any soldier right now in the guard. Don't self-select. Don't say, well, I can't do that because, or I feel I can't because someone said that. You make someone tell you, hey, here's a good example. I want to be a 14 Sierra Stinger crew member, but I'm only 62 inches. You have to be at least 64, right? So, hey, you can't do that. Yeah, I mean, okay, got it. I can't do that. But hey, I wanna go to Pathfinder. I wanna do airborne. I guess we can't get airborne slots, right? So you can't do that. But make sure you're not self-selecting. He told me that. Just if you want to become the state command sergeant major, then work to get there. And don't say, well, I'm not going to because I don't know if I'll get chosen to do that. So Dad was very influential in that. I think back when I went to Afghanistan, and he was also with me in Iraq. Was retired now for a certain Greg Brockberg. He was a phenomenal, leader in terms of his people, knowing them. It was the first time that he had ever done interviews with every single soldier in the battery that we had going to Afghanistan. We were 78, I think, strong when we left. And he told me, I was the readiness NCO and the platoon sergeant at the time. He said, I need to meet with every single soldier. I need to, sit down with them, do an interview, talk with them. And I thought, man, you're crazy, Top. We have so much to do. And he goes, nope, this is my priority. I need to know who I'm taking to war, and I need to know who's coming with me, and I need to know their families. And so he really put that in my brain that, man, you've got to know your people, you've got to understand them, and you got to dig deep on that. And it's not just, hey, how are you? I know Teg talks about that a lot. He says, if you ask the question, how are you doing? Everybody goes, yeah, fine. But then you ask the question, well, how's your family? What's the job? Where are you at right now in your career? What are some things that you're struggling with? And all of a sudden that opens up a good conversation and maybe find out something that, hey, this isn't good, or this is something that we need to work on. So he was great in that. Another one I have to talk about is probably retired Lieutenant Colonel Jody Abel. She is the epitome of knowledge, strength, toughness. I mean, she when we were in the NCR, she was the S3, and I worked directly with her as assistant S3, and it was busy and it was fun, and she drove that shop and did some great things up there, and I have to tip my cap to her. She was the one that always said, just keep working she maybe wanted me to go the officer side a little bit more, but you know, that ship had passed. I was already a little bit too old, you know, I had my degree and everything, but it wasn't necessarily going to be the route I was going to take. Maybe at a time there was a thought of that, but I just kind of stayed on the NCO side. But she was awesome and just said, you know, don't take the easy road. It was, you know, you have to, you know, do the hard right. Don't do the easy wrong. And if you do that, you know, things will work out. Colonel Bob Bull, I already talked about him. That little time we had, we didn't even have quite 2 years together, but I learned so much from him in the engineer world, but also managing people, managing the level of stress and taking time to reflect and before you make a rash decision. I had a tendency sometimes to just, I'm gonna make a decision right now, but he was always, hey, Sergeant Major, let's take a step back, let's analyze everything, let's look at possible solutions to this, and then we'll go forward together. And he taught me that command team role too, that really we gotta really focus together, that how we see things as a command team. And there were times we didn't see eye to eye, but we always, you know, agreed to work, we'd work through that and come up with a solution. So yeah, those are invaluable times for me. Yeah.
So we talked about mentorship and same thing with like leadership styles, ideals. So what would you say are some of the like core principles that guide your leadership style? You know, you talk about being strategic, but then also face-to-face time with soldiers. So what's your type of leadership style? What's guided you on
gotcha.
That?
And
what do you believe makes a successful leader
well,
in the Army?
I think I'm authoritative in my leadership style. Now, some people go, it's authoritarian is the bad one. So I got to make sure because authoritative is, you know, come with me. You know, authoritarian is you do that, you know, and the Army maybe was at one time more authoritarian, right? Hey, I remember in my early stages, I'm a learner. I'm a teacher by nature, and I need to know the whole. And then I'll figure out the parts. That's how I learn. But everybody has their different methods. And back in the day, it was, here's the little part. I'm not telling you anything about the big picture. You just need to do this. And I remember at basic, you know, you're going to climb in and out of foxhole for the next 10 minutes. And I'm like, why in the heck? And then here's this plastic thing you're going to hold in your left hand. You're going to hold it up and put it down and hold it. And then finally, we get to the end. Well, we're getting ready for the range, rehearsing for going out on the range. I said, just tell me we're going to the dang range, and I'll know why we're doing this. But that to me was the kind of, you know, one of those, I get it why the Army does that, but I think we need to be authoritative. We need to, practice the principles of mission command. That's where I drive my leadership style. You know, mutual trust. We got to have mutual trust. We have to have a shared vision, understanding. We need to be competent. We need to communicate. We have to have a clear vision, a clear understanding of what we're trying to do, where we're trying to go. And you have to connect with your people. You have to show them that you're invested. And I think those are the things I've done throughout my career. I tried to, in all aspects. I know that in Iraq when we were there, I was an E5, but obviously I was an older E5. I ended up getting the squad when our squad leader was he had to leave country right for a while, and so I took the squad as an E5. And there were things that maybe my current squad leader had done that I was like, I don't know if I'd run the squad that way. We'd come into a meeting and our platoon leadership said, hey, I need three bubbas from your team or your squad to come and do a whatever detail. So we'd come back from the meeting and we'd have our meeting at the squad leader level, and I'd go, all right, guys, I need two volunteers to go and do this detail at whatever time. And they'd all look at me after a while and they go, you know, hey, Sergeant Kachina, did they ask for two or three? And I said, don't worry about it. And then all of a sudden the whole squad would just raise their hand. Well, we're all going then, because they knew that, you know, I was never going to do something or give them something that I wouldn't do myself. And I think that's leading by example. And that's a big one, what I do, because, you know, if I'm going to tell you to be fit, I'm going to tell you to get your PME done, I'm going to do I better be doing that myself. So you really need to lead by example. You need to be clear in that and make sure that they understand, hey, you know, I'm going to put myself in harm's way right alongside with you if that's what it takes to get the mission done. So,
You've talked about it a few different times, that first deployment to Iraq. So when you were going out the door, what was your like main mission during that deployment? Like, what were you guys really focusing on? Yeah.
So we were air defense, but we didn't do any air defense, right? So we started training that, actually 4th of July, we got down into Fort Bliss, and we were there for almost 5 months. You know, we were doing and all we did was infantry tasks. From the simplest of tasks from up to complex collective tasks, but that's all we did. And we rolled into a JRTC rotation right after that. We did a JRT rotation. So we ended up doing pre-mob for about 6 months before we got into country. We had no idea. We knew that we were probably going to be do something outside the wire, something in our small fire team, something like that. So when we got there, we were under the 116th Brigade, which was underneath the, I can't remember now, 40th ID, which we're still kind of connected with, especially in the brigade. That's the division that we're supporting at the 141 MEB. But the 116th had a couple of battalions, and we've kind of fell under 3rd Tank or an FA battalion, but we were kind of given missions that nobody really wanted, it seemed like. We're like, hey, let's get those ADA guys to do that. So I remember when we were in Camp Buring, and we were getting ready to go up north into Kirkuk. That's where we were going to. And actually, this is another one about a leadership idea I can tie in with you. So this is we had our four trucks were going to go, and we didn't have any armor. We had no armor on these 1025s that we had back. You know, that was right during the time when, Secretary Rumsfeld was like, "What do you mean you don't have armor? Like, we don't have any armor." So, we had some welders that were welding on. They were from one of the engineer battalions, and they had stations. And you get your trucks in line. So we were gonna leave that next day. So I got our trucks online. We just slowly move up the line. It's getting later and later at night. I just told my guys, "Hey, I can jump these trucks up forward easy enough myself. I don't need all of you here. Go get some rack time, sleep, because we know we're SPing soon." So I just kept jumping those trucks, got them finally up to the line to get this ammo or get the armor welded on. And the welders there, they said, "Okay, you got to have all the brass out. All the brass, no live brass, or no ammo, nothing like that." So I had checked every one. We're like, "Yeah, I'm good. They get to the first truck, hook up, and they start looking around. They immediately find a piece of brass. So they go, "Nope, kick them back, end of the line." I was like, "Come on." And so, so I have to reverse all my trucks to the end of the line again. And then here I am just digging through every single one of the nooks, crannies of these Humvees, trying to find brass. And I'm finding more, and I'm like, "This is crazy." So I finally get up there again. They go to the first truck, and they pull, kick them back again. And I'm like, "You got to be kidding me. It's probably past midnight by now." And I'm upset. I'm swearing up a storm. I'm like, all of a sudden, I look on my shoulder. Here's Sergeant Major. His name is Sergeant Major Brooks. And he was a Sergeant Major for the FA battalion that we were falling under, the 116th. And he goes, what's going on, Sergeant? And I, "Sergeant Major, I've been trying to get these trucks in for getting this ammo or this armor welded on so we can we were actually the spearhead going into Iraq. We were the first four vehicles that were leading the brigade out." So I'm like, and he goes, "Okay, let's recock this and go back." So he helped me. We drove the trucks back to the end of the line, and we sat there, and we dug through every single one of those, found more brass, and we finally get up to the line again, and they hook up again, and first vehicle they pull up, and they go, "Oh," and Sergeant Major Brooks stands up, and he lets them have it. He's like, "You will get this done right now. Get this troop needs to get some sleep, you know, get back." And so that was pretty cool. And we did. We got the armor welded on. We got up online, and I think I just slept in the truck for about a half an hour, and then we were rolling out. But that was experience. So, you know, while we were there, we did everything from, we call it Rocket Man patrols, where there was a random guy shooting rockets into the FOB. We try to find him. We did a route clearance. We did detainee ops. We did some knocks and searches. Everything under the sun that we did there. But nothing air defense. The closest thing we got was maybe sitting on top of a roof with a sniper team. But that's about it. So, air defense was not what we all thought. Well, we should probably have earned a infantry, you know, badge or something like that, or an MOS, but they, no. So you go 2 weeks, you can transition to get infantry MOS, but you can't for 6 months to train up, but, and then a year deployment. So, but yeah, that was one, you know, looking back at my experiences too, that whole time I spent, with Fox Battery and preparing for that deployment and then the deployment itself. And even to this day, I still stay in contact with, some very, very close people in my life that really formed my direction in the military was that deployment.
I feel like I could ask you probably 100 more questions about your early deployments, but yeah. I want to definitely jump to the current role as a, you know, State Command Sergeant Major. So taking over that role as the, you know, State CSM, what's your primary goals for the institution within your role?
So, you know, I will tag off the, I guess, the lines of effort we have, and it's people, mission, teams. And I know that's our initiative, and people may hear that, but that is that's all of it, right in a nutshell, because our people are obviously our most important asset. One thing I do want to focus on is career management at the NCO level, and that means making sure that we're completing our PME, we're getting, even though, you know, the step is now suspended, it's vital that we stay on top of that. Go to your PME when you can as an NCO. Make sure we complete that. The other thing is to make sure we're developing our mentor and mentee program. I see that as something, I think, across the enterprise, not just the National Guard, but active duty. And I saw that in the as a commandant role, coming into the RTI and also, and just talking with those soldiers from across all compos, you know, hey, did you get counseled? Have you been talked to by a, you know, by your raider, by your senior raider, by someone in your chain of command about your job, what you should be doing, or what your next, you know, your next assignment might be, you know, what, and that's not, I don't think, happening as much as, I know it's not happening as much as it should. So I want to really focus on that. I always say to an NCO, especially a new NCO, the first time that you see your NCR better not be the time you're signing it. You better be involved in that process. You better, that's your career. That is your evaluation. If you aren't being counseled, you aren't being talked to by your raider, then you schedule an appointment. You ask them, hey, Sergeant, I need to sit down. I haven't been counseled. I need to know what my job is. I want you to tell me what I need to do to be productive, to be better at my position. You have to take ownership to that. A lot of the time, and I heard this so many times from E6s, E7s, full-time, M-Day, they're saying, well, I've never been counseled in my position, never been talked to in my position. I'm, you know, the Army, you know, they didn't give me a fair shake because they didn't rate me correctly. Well, were you involved in the process? And they look at me like, you know, I got a unicorn, like a horn grown on my forehead or something. Like, wait, and I said, yeah. I get it, what the AR says. Sure, the senior raider owns the process of an NCOAR, but you as the rated soldier, you own that. You should be the one asking the question, asking, what do I need to do? You know, and we need to develop that better as E7s and E8s and as at that role and also on the officer side to be, if I'm rating an NCO, I got to get, you know, understanding of what I expect them to do. When I took over for the battalion CSM of the 142, I don't know if I surprised Colonel Bowl by this, and he'll probably chuckle if he hears this, but I sent him, hey, here's who I am, here's what I can do for you. And I did a little diagram, right? And it had arrows, and it had battalion CSM in the middle, and it had staff, it had community, it had battalions, or companies, and then I had friction points. And I said, this is what I will do for you, sir. You know, I'll step into this role and find out what the friction points are, give that information to you, and work through that, and together as a command team we'll find solutions. And when we talked, he said, I don't think, you know, I think that's the best counseling I've ever done, and I didn't even initiate it. And I was like, well, that's, you know, that's what we need to start doing is take an active role in that. So with that, I guess that'll enhance talent management and progression and making sure we're putting the right people in the right places at the right time. Too many times, I mean, we have some brilliant people in the force. And they may be satisfied right now with the position they're in, but maybe they don't know, you know, what that next position is. And we have to take advantage of that because I think we're there, but we just need to do a little bit better at that. So I guess the other things I want to make sure we do is improve our physical and mental readiness, behavioral health. I want to make sure we're focusing on being resilient. There's so many different avenues to that. And the biggest thing there that we can affect is the communication, like I said, getting to know your people, and not just a, hey, how are you doing, a drill, but really, really getting down to the weeds. And I preach that from, I guess, one of the main things I've always said, you know, in whatever position I'm in, is you got to know your people intimately. You have to be involved with their lives. I use the word, I guess the phrase, positively intrusive. All right, that's where you need to be. And it's sometimes uncomfortable. It's sometimes difficult to have those conversations. But if we do that and we focus on those things, then we'll be successful.
Then how would you measure success for the State Command Sergeant Major role? Like, what are some key indicators that you would look at to make sure you're meeting that?
Yeah, it's tough, because that's a good question, because, you know, when we're trying to measure, we always want our bubble charts green and stuff like that, right? And there are things we can look at, like soldier readiness, you know, a percentage of that. Like, our MedDet does a great job making sure that we're physically ready to go. So that's a metric, easy one, that we can pull out. Retention and recruiting, you know, if we're keeping our retention attrition low, you know, we're making sure we're meeting the mark, keeping our people in, and we're recruiting, because we gotta have boots to be able to train. If we don't, that's a fault. So those are things that we can look at. Equipment readiness, making sure our maintenance side is always top notch, which it is. I mean, our maintainers are extraordinary. Our numbers at the RTI, making sure that we're keeping that course load. So those are easy ones, I think, to measure, right? The difficult ones are those non-tangibles, or the ones that we have, like climate control, our climates, our climate trends, our command, when we get those feedbacks to see where we're at, so we can, you know, see those and make sure that we're meeting that mark in terms of giving our soldiers what they need. We need to have cohesive, strong teams that can, you know, deploy anywhere at any time and do the mission at night and be successful. And we're building readiness, you know, tough individuals, but how do we measure that? Well, you know, we're out, you know, in austere environments. We're out doing tough annual trainings. Maybe we're out doing difficult nighttime maneuvers that are building that. So, and then we can evaluate from there. I know that we try to get to our national training centers or JRTCs, which probably aren't going to happen as much due to funding, but we can still, I guess, have that during our annual trainings, during our IDTs, and make sure that we're doing good quality feedback AARs, and that's a good way to assess and truly assess where we're at in terms of readiness and lethality, like the Army commander would say. So,
yeah. And then throwing that strategic hat back on, looking ahead, you know, we say 5-10 years further out, what does the success of the North Dakota National Guard look like? What innovations or changes?
Yeah, I know, that's awesome, because there are, that's an eye-opener for me too, the things that we're involved in. I think our relationships with the UAS, UND, I am a UND grad, so I got to plug them a little bit now. But, you know, their foresight and how to tie that in and what we're going to look like in terms of how that ties into our mission here. And it is somewhat of an air defense, but it's also an engineer asset that we're going to have to utilize. And I think the future of warfare, if we're talking near peer and Lisco and those things, that's part of it, is a UAS is going to be dominant. That first person view is another one, that as we look at the war in Ukraine and how that has affected that, I think if we're not steering toward that somehow, and I know that the Air Guard is looking at that a lot more than the, maybe the Army side, but I think that's something that will definitely be a future for us in the North Dakota Guard. We look at transition and contact, right? That initiative that we're working on. It's funny, because the transition in contact is not necessarily getting modernization, getting the new equipment. That will come, but that's definitely probably, you know, a lot further along than we'd like it to be. I can't tell exactly from, you know, where we're going to be in that fielding, but it will be down the road. So what does that mean? It means taking the equipment you currently have and figuring out how to use that in a different way. And it's there's some great podcasts, some great information out there to read and see how some of these BCTs are out in like the NTC going, all right, here's an E4 that's in the six that has a brilliant idea on how to utilize some of this equipment to mask the electromagnetic signal or however it may be. And they're not getting new equipment, but they're figuring out different ways to conduct the fight. And we have that here. We have some, like I said, brilliant people in the force that, hey, here's what you've got. How can we do this differently? And they're already doing that. They're in the field figuring that out, trying to, you know, how do I get my talk to be able to be smaller and mobile, and how can I still communicate? And I see that when I go out to the training events, go, wow, that's a great idea. And I think as we look to the future, that, you know, 5 to 10 years down the road, we will get that equipment, but in the interim, we're going to have to build those relationships with, like I said, with our agencies that we have in North Dakota, and then keep, pushing through with that equipment we do have to figure out new ways to make it work. So.
And you brought up bringing a grad as well, but you also have a master's in educational leadership,
yeah,
which is a great degree to have when you're the commandant of the
Institute.
So that's pretty big. And you focused heavily on education and training throughout. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you pair that with the military side with like a sergeant's major academy.
Yeah.
Putting those two together, how would you say your civilian education has changed your approach to training and development within the military?
Well, I think, you know, more shifting from compliance to competence, right? Not just I'll do that because I'm told, but because I'm smart, I'm good at it. I want to be good at something. I want to know, how to view a problem set and how to come up with a solution. My education has, I will say, I'm still a lifelong learner. I'm learning something all the time. I'm always Colonel Klecki will be another one. He is our G3, and he's the 142 commander now, a very, very good friend of mine. And he is phenomenal at understanding doctrine and reading doctrine and being able to implement that and seeing not just the immediate but the long-term effects of it. And knowing how to use that, how to think through it, I think having that educational background and through the Sergeant Major Academy, through my master's, has give me the ability to kind of look at a lot of information, condense it, and then use it. So it's something at the RTI, you know, being involved in education. I wasn't, you know, people think, oh, the commandant, no, I'm not teaching. I'm not an instructor. Those instructors are way better than I am at being able to teach a carpenter or an electrician or anything like that. They're phenomenal at that. I'm there just to basically manage, right? But I'm also there to make sure that we're doing the right things for our future and positioning that and following the right guidance. The guidance is put out there for us to analyze, to use, and then how do we implement it? How do we use it? So I guess from that, always putting that learning piece ahead, just making sure that we all learn at different levels, different ways, different thoughts, and trying to figure out what adult learning strategy is going to work for whoever that is, if it's a platoon sergeant or if it's a first sergeant, whoever it may be. We have the tendency in the Army to just put PowerPoint up. We'll just do that, right? And I've said this a million times, but I will do a PowerPoint class now and be engaging, whatever it may be. And the next day I'll go and ask specialists, whoever, hey, what was that PowerPoint that we had yesterday? They'll look at me going, I have no idea, Sergeant Major. I just don't know through the whole thing. So, you know, we got to be able to figure out what makes everyone tick. You can't hit everybody, you know, with every single class, every single training event, but you can if you focus, you know, on it. So that has given me that ability, I think, for it throughout my education.
So then if we look back at the span of your career, if you were to, you know, take that young specialist you just mentioned, yeah, and give that young soldier who's just starting their career in the North Dakota, yeah, National Guard, what's that piece of advice you'd like, yeah, to share with them that you got or you wish you, yeah, received when you were that young
soldier? I would say own your career from day one. Own it. And you are responsible for your success. You need to be involved in it. I think often we're coming into the guard at that level thinking, oh, I just want to be taken care of. But you've got to understand that, you know, what you learn, what you do. And I'll say too that there's going to be different levels of people coming in. I was 29 years old. I came in as an E4. I had a degree. I had a definite direction that I wanted. But are really looking at those 18 to probably 25 year olds, right, that are in their life right now, just maybe graduating high school, just maybe starting college, maybe starting a job. They're what they're dealing with, what they're working on is going to be different in every situation. But I will say that's the number one is own your career right away and get involved, get proficient at your job and learn it well and take care of yourself, take care of your family, take care of those other things in your life at that level, because there's a lot of changes going on. You know, you're probably finishing college or, you know, just starting your career, whatever it may be. Maybe look at starting a family, you know, at that first 6 years, you know, 8 years of your career. So there's a lot in there. There's a lot of tension packed in there. And you've got to focus on owning that. So.
And that brings us right to about time, but any final thoughts or anything you'd like to share with listeners out there about your journey or philosophy?
I should have went on to this one, but I want to add in. So those are our new enlisted, right? Talking about, well, where are we at for, you know, our mid soldiers, our soldiers that have got, you know, that 12, 14, 16 years in, and they're 26 to 40 years old, right? What do they focus on? And I want them to be mentors. I want them to think about who is going to replace you, right? Think about how, you know, and it's hard. A mentor-mentee relationship isn't something that you just assign, right? It doesn't work that way. You as a mentee, you need to go, you know, I really want to learn from this person. And then you ask them, right? But you also have to be open to that at that level too and say, I want to be your mentee. I want to give you some advice, try to help you through these things. Now, we can assign coaches, and I think we get a little bit misled on what a mentor and a coach are. But a coach is someone who's just going to, you know, give you those parameters, set you up for success. A mentor is someone that's going to guide you, is going to give you advice, is going to give you stories, going to give you help. And that relationship is something at that level you really need to foster, really need to get connected. And think about who is your replacement. If you're a first sergeant right now, a battalion CSM, you know, who is that behind you? And then vice versa from that, who is that behind them? And that's something important we need to keep nurturing and try to get that ingrained in the culture that we're doing. So,
awesome. Thank you so much, Sergeant Major, for those final thoughts. That was State Command Sergeant Major Kenneth Kuchina, who is our new State Command Sergeant Major for the state of North Dakota. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you, Nathan. I appreciate that. Yeah. Okay.
And thank you to all the listeners out there tuning in to another episode of the podcast. Thanks for joining us.